Welcome to University Matters. This is Patricia Camilleri, Director of Communications and Alumni Relations here at the University of Malta. In this series, I will be talking to academic staff about their research projects, their international networks, about their aims and aspirations. I shall also be hearing from staff and students and visitors to campus about the many events that take place here at the University of Malta. I'm very happy to have with me today on University Matters, Dr. Adriana Vella, who is from the Department of Biology, where she is a senior lecturer. Just a few words about my guest. After obtaining her honours degree at the University of Malta, she specialised at Cambridge in genetics, ecology, evolution and conservation at a master's level, and also in biology, population biology and conservation for her PhD. Subsequently, she joined the Conservation Research Center in Virginia, USA, for further specialization in molecular genetics techniques applied to conservation assessment of vulnerable or endangered species. Her current research interests lie in conservation biology and conservation risk assessment. She has introduced the first courses in conservation biology at the University of Malta and offers advice and consultancy in conservation issues. Projects undertaken by her include the National and Regional Cetacean Conservation Research Project since 1996, Bluefin Tuna Research since 1998, Elasmobranchs Research, I hope I pronounced that correctly. Sustainable Fishing and Ecotourism, Mammal Conservation Research Projects, including bats and hedgehogs, Biodiversity Assessments for Conservation. She's supervising work in the SCGE Comet Assay Technique to measure the genetic integrity of bioindicators of habitat quality, and I'm sure she'll explain what all that means to us. Conservation and population genetics of sharks and groupers, amongst various other marine animals. Dr. Vella is participating in the European Platform for Biodiversity Research Strategy as a steering committee member and is coordinator of the Maltese National Biodiversity Platform, which was launched as part of an EU project and is currently a partner in the Biodiversity EU project Biostrat. She's been invited to participate in various conferences, of course, and we look forward to hearing about this obviously extremely topical issue. Well, in this series, we're looking at the work that goes on. Perhaps in the past we've concentrated mostly on the research of our academics, and I hope that we'll have a chance to discuss that. But that research obviously translates into what you do with your students. My first question to you, what subjects do you actually lecture in, and how do you really get these students to be involved in this fascinating subject?
So the areas I lecture are actually diverse in a certain respect, because apart from conservation biology, as you very well mentioned, I also lecture in biochemistry, genetics, developmental biology, and obviously research techniques. Now, the biochemistry, genetics, and developmental biology are usually tackled and looked at by many biology students as the tough guys, so as to say, the tough notch, because there is a lot of complex equations, very detailed information that you have to learn and understand to really then grasp how fascinating the subject is. But to get them through this dark tunnel, shall I say so, to see the light is not always easy. So unless you do not try to diversify it, I usually as a person hate going in, giving a lecture and going out. For me, it's a no-go. So I usually prefer going in, try to put in, obviously the content has to be given, but as much as possible to have participation, discussions, questions. I'm always constantly stopping and making sure that they get involved. Obviously, each subject has its own way then to make it more unique. For example, conservation biology, you have the beauty of case studies, both international and local, and why not even see the actual setup in the local scenario. You've got biochemistry. Biochemistry for many is just lots of equations and reactions and cycles. But when you look at it from an everyday perspective, for example, why should the chips that are cooked have a change in taste while going through a biochemical, so as to say, process, or why in our body, if we get a particular medicine, it will affect us in certain ways. What again, what biochemical process? So although I make sure that all the content is covered, then I always try to make sure that there is a slot of the time allocated to going beyond that. Let's see how this is applied, how this is relevant in this day and age. Obviously, genetics. Who knows how many of our youths and adults see these famous now programs and films and detective scenes and forensics where they use nothing now but genetics. So DNA coming up and DNA coming down and find DNA from here and DNA from that. So in a way, the fact that now they can relate to the applications, not just with humans, but also to the fascinating area of the animal and plant kingdom, where, for example, if we want to protect trees and wood, now we can actually assess whether the wood has come from trees that are, so to say, grown on purpose for furniture, rather than trees that are protected by law and should not have been logged, or catching fish that you are selling, like one particular species, whereas indeed there are some other species, as has indeed been found again from such techniques. Appreciating that we can actually be much more in control from the information that we get from such techniques. For example, if before we wanted to, protect or sustain a particular stock of fish that we wanted to exploit because it is available, to do that without waiting until we get to a level whereby the genetic pool of this stock has become so poor that you know there are the signals that it will soon perish, you have this tool as well. So developmental biology then. Developmental biology is a fascinating area because usually at first sight you say, oh, it is, we're going to cover the development of a human being. That is how it all starts from fertilization to the first few cells to becoming this intricately very complex organism. And if something goes wrong, at any point, the consequences are tremendous. For me, especially as a mother, It's a miracle of life every time you think about it. But imagine thinking about that same route for every single organism that is around us, that they have these different ways of doing it, different ways of getting to a different structure, and all determined by the genetics, by the environment within which this occurs. So in particularly for developmental biology, I want the students to be involved through actually preparing also some of the presentations if not being able to do it themselves, having tutorial groups where we subdivide the topics, have over and above the lectures, as we're saying here, we meet separately in subgroups, we start looking at how the topic has to be evolved, how the section that they will be looking into makes sense, and then giving them the opportunity to present and discuss with the rest of the group. So while doing this, they are already internalizing the subject and bringing out all their difficulties even before, at least when we speak of group, even before then discussing it with the rest of the group. And this gives them, I think, the opportunity, which is rather unique, of feeling much more part of a subject that otherwise they would have said, oh, but this is too complex, it has so many things, how can I just sit down there and try to absorb all these different details, whereas the opposite occurs.
And the students, when they come to you, they may have some favorite subject in their minds, but then I suppose listening to you speak, one can get an idea of the vastness of the subject, and therefore in the first year I suppose they get introduced to all these various aspects that perhaps they hadn't even considered before they actually attended the courses, and from there they can start, I presume, getting more interested either in the subject they were interested in before, or perhaps discovering subjects which can be of interest to them which they didn't know about.
Yes, definitely, definitely so. And one nice thing is the way in which they are, supposed to say, introduced at different years. For example, conservation biology, I have both an introductory course in the first year and then a much more advanced course in the fourth year. Biochemistry comes second year. Genetics and developmental biology, third year, because it depends so much, as you rightly said, on previously acquired understanding of concepts, of details, of examples. So the course itself as well allows for this progression of understanding. And that is why, as we progress to a more advanced level, we also demand more participation from the student. The first year, you know, they are all new to the system. Yes, finding the system. You don't really want to overload them. But from second year, especially third year and fourth year, I think it is very important to start giving that confidence. But listen, learning is not just for the lecturers. It's not like a top-down affair, but it should be also, listen, wanting to reach out to knowledge, because at the end of the 4 years, this is what they'll have to do on their own two feet, being able to.
That's it. A responsibility as well, because it's an area where you're giving them skills which they will then take out into the workplace in a scientific area where getting it right and doing things properly is going to be key to their work, to their careers, really.
Yes, definitely so. And in fact, here I can speak about the skills that personally I wish to see every single student acquire. For example, I'm going to start from the being able to express ideas and opinions clearly. I think this seems something basic, something that any student could do, but you'd be amazed how when you give them 5 minutes, okay, go out there in front of the rest of the class and give me 5 minutes of your opinion or what you have found. And you will see that maybe half of them will have difficulty in doing this because they would not have had the opportunity to do this before. And I think we should have much more of this, much more of allowing them to express things with their colleagues. After all, we're not doing it with some stranger group or because that comes later when you go to a conference and start presenting your data. So that is definitely something that I look for. Then there is critical assessment of information. There's a lot of information out there. Some is rubbish, some is medium, some is excellent. How can you actually assess? That also requires training. And I think this is something that I really look forward to with my students, especially those that then go into selecting a research project. Because they need to do that. There is a lot of information out there. Just let's speak about the internet here. And everybody Googles everything, yes, nowadays. Again, out there, you're going to find very good information. Excellent. You know, but you're going to find even mediocre information. So that's another thing. Execution of methods which are accurately undertaken, especially for science. I mean, if you're not capable to not only know what methods are available, but to execute those methods carefully, accurately, and know that the outcomes can then translate to something that is meaningful, that can be of use, then I think if you have not developed that as a scientist, then you'll be of no use, actually, to the community. So these are, I think, the basics. Then there is what we call the additional, training that I in particular instill on those taking conservation biology. That is awareness. That it is not, for the scientists, it's not anymore enough to do research, to acquire new knowledge, to actually make discoveries. But these discoveries must be shared. They must be made to be useful to the policymaker, to the manager, to the government, to the public, because the public is more and more becoming a very, very important aspect of decisions and of running of good behavior, so to say.
Yes, these are definitely skills that should be learned across the board, really, at university, because nowadays people have to go out there and they're not going to be a scientist on their own in the corner of a laboratory. Things just don't work. They weren't ever really like that, but certainly not now. And also, in you were mentioning conservation, an area which is much discussed, therefore it's important for the researcher to see the context and to understand the politics with a small p,
yes,
and sometimes also with a capital P, of a situation, to be able to evaluate everything from all sides, I presume.
First and foremost, as a scientist, I think the obligation that one has is to always be objective. And that is not always easy, because especially with topics that nowadays are translate to money, there are those that will say, oh, but as a scientist working with A, then you should somehow change your outcome to please us. Whereas as a scientist, ethically speaking, you cannot do that. So you might also have to be prepared of not always being popular or not always being pleasing in what you are going to present. But the integrity, I think, of a scientist comes from that you can be honest, that what you are relating relates to what has been analyzed, to what has been observed, to what has been scientifically investigated, and not just a matter of opinion, because that is something else. So a scientist has to be very careful when he's saying, this is my opinion, or this is my, so to say, wisdom from experience, and this is what has come out from research. Okay? Because the two things might not always be the same.
Exactly. No. It takes a courageous person to actually admit sometimes that their hypothesis hasn't
been correct.
Fruition.
Yes, exactly. Definitely so.
And that brings me on to my next question, which was about the research projects of your students. How do you go about choosing? I mean, every year you must have to come up with myriad ideas.
First of all, Tricia, I must say that in conservation biology, and especially in the areas that now I have been trying to develop even within the Department of Biology, that is not only conservation in the field, that means field observation where you base a lot on ecology and studies with impacts where there are human activities and you have to analyze those as well, but to use sophisticated tools. That is, know that genetics, for example, has a way of addressing certain analysis in shorter time and therefore giving you more in-depth information than if you would have done, for example, 10 years observing a particular population. So the fact that there are tools out there that make your work much more efficient, I think it is a duty for us at university to make these students as competitive as possible once they go out there. So while choosing, this has to be taken into consideration. Now, the drawback is, and this is, I think, where we need to work hard as a university, that these titles might at times be shrunk down because of limitations of funds, very often. But I always say that should not keep us back from really doing our best, and why not even finding supporters of such research outside the university. So trying to do both, asking for the university to assist and external entities, I think the research has been managing to develop in the department, even in sophisticated and, shall I say, demanding areas like in conservation genetics. And this brings me therefore to what you were saying. How do we go about deciding which topics are not only original and therefore a contribution to science, but relevant in this day and age in Malta, but also in Europe, because we're part of Europe. And therefore there is the regional aspect that comes into it. And the beauty of selecting one particular species that has been just reported to become now overexploited, when your department or your research has actually been tackling that species about, shall I say, 10 years before, gives you great satisfaction, because that means that the tuning in to your, or putting your ears, so to say, on the ground to really feel the needs of research are good. Because otherwise, fine-tuned, you feel that you know what needs to be addressed well in advance than any other entity, not even the ministry or the local public might have thought of. So I think this is also a requirement of researchers at the university, to be not only original, but relevant and as much as possible in time, so that once the scientist has produced results, it is just on time for when people are really needing that information and therefore being in a position to do something about it, especially in this day and age where we always say that we need more science and we need to develop sustainably. I think these two are the pillars of what we need to keep in mind.
And here, with the first research stage would be an undergraduate level. And sometimes I complain that I hear about such a lot of work that goes on and it just doesn't see the light of day. how do you manage to, or do you manage to, have, after having chosen these relevant subjects, do you manage to get the good research out there, or does it remain on the shelf?
Very good question, because I strongly believe, I've always strongly believed, that science should be out there. Science should be not only appreciated by the public, and they cannot appreciate science if they are not informed about it. So from the very start, ever since I started working here, I always opened my, so to say, doors to the public through features, television interviews, people coming along and asking what are you doing and all this, because then they read the feature and they would like to know more. And through being so much closely linked with people, because we're all in the same boat, after all. I mean, we are teeny-weeny islands, we have limited space, limited resources, and we need to appreciate what's going on, rather than living quite blindly, thinking that the only problems we have are within our home. So trying to tackle these things, and knowing that there are ways and means of studying, analyzing, and therefore bringing the information in time, as I was saying before, to do something about it, I think even people start appreciating that, yes, this type of science makes sense. This type of science that we should all be promoting, because even if my child is not doing that particular research, or I'm not that researcher, the outcomes of that research will not only come back to us, because we'll get to know what's going on, but can assist relevant, the government of the day, the policymaker of the day, to do the proper choices. Obviously, Tricia, here I must point out that just because the scientist does his duty of producing this to the public and to the that they are taken into consideration. That is, but at least the conscience of the scientist is that he or she has done her utmost or his utmost to make sure that the information did not remain, as you were very well said, oh, I published 101 papers, but none of them got anywhere, except in the journal where they were published. And I think here there is the importance of the what we call outreach, that is that the information is then put in simple terms, and I think this is also the duty of the scientists to do it in simple terms, and spread out to all relevant entities as much as possible.
Do you hold symposia with your students? Do they get a chance to stand up and talk about their dissertations?
Now, as regards symposia, I will speak very candidly. It's not just my topics that get this opportunity, but the department, because the department has been very well prepared in this respect, and every year holds a biology symposium. So that is already in itself a very, very good thing. So members of the public, but mostly, usually prospective students, come along and listen. Maybe more of the public should. And to do that, however, the symposia should be presented in a much more lay way, not so much scientific terms, but maybe made more, shall I say, friendly to everyone. And that's where I usually stress that students should go beyond just the symposium, because the symposium is like a preparation for conferences where you're going to speak with other experts, so you don't have to go down to the nitty-gritty of things. But when you are giving an interview, when you are writing a feature on a newspaper, when you are going to try and speak to school kids, the level will have to be completely different. Therefore, to have a bit of training in this, I think, is vital for a scientist in this day and age, and should be appreciated, because it's not a waste of time. It is an essential part of what a scientist should be doing.
It's one of my big problems as a public relations person who's dealing with the media, and sometimes we have very important things that happen scientifically on campus, and getting the scientists to actually talk about it in terms that would be relevant to a general public, it's very difficult for them, and I appreciate very much that it is difficult for them to do
that. Yes, definitely it is going to be difficult for them, because, I mean, the first times I was doing it, I felt it very difficult. So how am I going to translate all those terminologies, all those that details or years of experience gained into simple terms? But I think it is something that has to be done for the benefit of not only science becoming much more part of our routines, but also making people appreciate that science is not just something awkward, something strange, alien from their life, but something much more part of everything they do, actually.
In the last few minutes that we have left, I would like you just to talk a little bit about the research which you personally are involved in at the moment, because I know that obviously as we heard in the introduction, I mean, biodiversity is really your thing. You love your dolphins, and bluefin tuna, of course, has been an important issue as well.
Yes, Tricia, very quickly, I will say that maybe many people know me mostly from the dolphin research that I've launched quite some good number of years ago, really because it's an animal that is, shall I say, liked by the public. So they might say, she's the dolphin lady. But indeed, as you rightly said, dolphins is one project which I want to keep because very often these animals are looked at soft toys. They're cute creatures, but we forget that they have a very serious and important contribution to do in their ecosystem. They are part of a whole network of biodiversity, and if we cannot even find them anymore, that means that there's something wrong in this network of life. And so they are very good for so as indicators. But apart from them, there are many other incredible species out there, from the tiniest to the largest. You mentioned bluefin tuna. Here we go into what we call exploiting species, and therefore in an area which tends to be very hot, or shall I say, an area that some people might not understand. Why should we study? Why should we conserve a species that we have for hundreds of years exploited without any problems? Well, there is a problem that we are becoming always much better at it. That means we
greedy.
Not just greedy, but we're becoming even the few that there would be. Let's say we cut the fish. The fishermen that go for tuna to literally a fraction. If those that are left to do it in a method which is so efficient, using satellites, nocturnal devices, you find them regardless of whether it's bad weather, good weather, give them no chance whatsoever. And I think that is the problem, rather than, I already said that bluefin tuna is a very nice case in point, whereby we can see artisanal fishermen that have caught it in their simplistic way with very limited numbers. A whole community here in Malta used to survive out of, and what they used to catch was sustainable. It is when we started going into wanting to make use of purseining more, wanting to have new ways of making benefit of this resource, that we might have gone astray and said, listen, are we still as sustainable as we were? Are we going to contribute to sustainable fishing of the, or are we going to join the increasing surge of purseiners in the Mediterranean that all go on the same site where the dolphin, by the way, might be thinking of, sorry, the tuna would be thinking about other things because they would be spawning. And in that vulnerable situation, they are obviously caught in their thousands, okay? And I think this deserved, I think, decent research, detailed research, genetic research that was presented in various places and international fora, including ICAT, which happens to be the International Convention for the Conservation of Atlantic Tuna. And the results that came out are very, very interesting indeed. I mean, even countries abroad say, wow, the information that seems to be coming out and the fact that tuna is not like one population, but they are very much maybe like salmon that are dedicated and they will go back very faithfully to the place where they were born. So in other words, what does this mean? That if we cut off the tuna that happens to be close to us, then that batch that very faithfully comes there to reproduce will not be able to reproduce. What does that mean? That tomorrow the young will not be born there and therefore there's nothing coming back to that place.
We have lost them. Well, I knew that this was going to be a problem of time today. We'll have to have another program to talk about the other aspects of your research. Dr. Adriana Vella, thank you very, very much for coming to talk to us on University Matters today. Thank you for listening to today's program. I do hope you can join us again next week for another in the series, University Matters on Campus FM. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.